Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello there, welcome to a brand new Arseblog Arsecast right here on arseblog.com. Hope you're well. I'm a little bit cheesed off because this is the second time that I've done the intro to this show. The first time, well, I mean, I have to say it's like a piece of art that has been lost to the world. Because for some reason, and for the second time this has happened to me this week, well, not to me, but it happened to somebody else, but I was kind of in charge of it, a whole recording just didn't work. It was there. I saw it. I saved it. And somehow, I don't know what happened, but it's gone. Forever. There's no reclaiming it. Nothing. Although, I do have that time machine thing, don't I, on my computer. I do. I have the time machine. I can go back in time and get it, but that seems like an awful lot of hassle. And I've already started this again, so we might as well just sort of keep going, I guess. Anyway, I do hope you're well. We're going to be talking about Arsenal on this podcast, as we do. It's a podcast about Arsenal, and we're going to have to discuss the midweek shenanigans, the failings in front of goal. 21 shots, no goals. There's a joke in there somewhere, isn't there, about drinking 21 shots and, you know, picking up penalty points or something. But, you know, I just can't be arsed. I don't have it in me. I don't have the gumption. I don't have the will. Because it's been one of those weeks, Arsenal aside, where it's been testing. Very testing. You won't know this, of course, unless you live in Ireland or you have, for some bizarre reason, a keen interest in Irish politics. But they've called a general election here. And I find general elections kind of irritating. Mostly, I have to say, because of, well, politicians. Because they're just, you know, pain in the arse. Maybe there are some of you out there listening to this very podcast right now who have forged a career in politics, and maybe you're an okay person. Deep down beneath the veneer of, like, saying what people want you to say, that you're okay, I guess. But here, politicians, fuck them. They're assholes. And the whole election is like it's a total Hobson's choice. Because the government, well, they're shit and dickheads. And the opposition, they're also shit and dickheads. So I'm kind of in a position where, you know, I don't want to vote for any of these people. We had one candidate call to the door the other day and he said, I'm here on behalf of whatever political party it was. And I said, no, thank you. And he said, why not? And I said, I don't agree with your policies. And he went, which ones? And I said, pretty much all of them. And he went, oh. And he left, which was fine. I don't mind being honest with them. But the bigger problem, of course, is the posters. Posters everywhere. And what is on the posters but pictures of politicians? Now, I have a theory about politicians. It may well be specific to Irish politicians. I haven't really given it much thought beyond these shores. But you know the way, if there's an actor who is not, shall we say, conventionally handsome, whose face might be somewhat distinctive in its less than handsomeness. And you very often hear these people referred to as character actors, right? And that basically they're just saying they're really kind of ugly. That's the way they say it. They're being diplomatic or whatever. But those people have realized, hey, I'm no Cary Grant, I'm no George Clooney, I'm no that guy from that film, the Drive film, the goose guy, what's his name? Fuck it, I can't remember his name, but he's a goose. Ryan Gosling, that guy. They realize they're not him, and they say, hey, that's all right, I am who I am, I accept my face for what it is, and I will entertain the world through my performances, through my art, through my creativity. And I think they're fantastic. But politicians, these are the people who cannot accept the fact that they're basically hideous, right? And the way that they decide to deal with having a face that looks like it's been put together from spare parts is not to entertain, is not to create, is not to give something back to the world, it's to seize power. This is how they compensate for looking like something. Do you remember that kids game where you had to pick the eyes of one thing and a different nose and a you know, a different mouth and, you know, all kinds of, you just put it together, it would look hideous. That's what they all look like. And then what they do at election time is they put up pictures of themselves all over. Lampposts, every street corner, traffic lights. There's a picture of this ugly person or that ugly person and that ugly person. And I'm like, I don't want to vote for any of you. Because if you vote for them and they get elected, what happens then? They're on the TV. They're on the radio all the time. They're in the newspapers. They're in the magazines. You have to look at them even more. And frankly, when it comes right down to it, do we not have the weight of evidence, like over the years of humanity, that the worst people to be making any decisions about anything are politicians? If you look back at it, right? They've got a track record of being absolutely shit all the time. What is every election based on? The same fucking things time and time again. Health service, unemployment, taxes. They've had fucking hundreds of years to sort this shit out, and they're no good at it. Now, that might be because, basically, they don't give a fuck about any of that stuff. They go into politics to, A, have some power, B, get a pension, make connections, make more money, to gild their own lilies. They have the gildedest lilies anywhere, you know? So fuck these guys and fuck their posters. It's really annoying. So anyway, that's been a trying part of this week for me. Thankfully, this election ends on February 26th. That's when the election is. So we don't have long. We don't have this huge, long campaign like they do in the States, which has been running for how the fuck long now? And it's in October, the election. Of course, more people are interested in U.S. politics because we all want to know if the crazy man is going to get in and blow up the world. So I think we have to, you know, take a vested interest in what goes on over there. But look, this will be the last Irish general election update on this podcast. I promise. Probably. Unless they put up more posters and stuff. In which case, I may have to have another rant. Get the posters. Fuck off. So look, going back from that to what happened in midweek, drawing 0-0 with Southampton, taking all those shots, missing all those great chances to score. Ah, oh, we should have scored. We really should have scored. I know the performance wasn't great, but we really should have scored. Mesut Ozil, that first one, right? I think he probably should have scored it, but I could see what he was trying to do. Like the ball over the top, the first touch was amazing, and the finish, I think he was just trying to put it either between the keeper's legs or just like either side of him a tiny bit, because if that had gone in, let's face it, we could be talking about a candidate for one of the coolest goals of all time. Because it would have been absolutely fantastic. The first touch, just sublime. I wish he would have just been a bit more decisive with the finish, though. The second one, I think that's a miss. I think that's a big miss. People talk about the keeper making a save. I think he hit the ball at the keeper rather than the keeper making a save. I'll draw a parallel with the game against Liverpool. Oh, sorry. The game against Liverpool earlier in the season, and you might remember that the ball was squared from our right-hand side to Benteke, and it came to him from very, very close range, and Petr Cech made a save. He made a decision. He guessed or tried to gamble where the ball was going to go. He waited for him to take it. He dived. He pushed the ball around the post. That was a brilliant save. When you look back at it, actually, it's just one of the best saves I've seen. Because he was so close to goal and he had to use all his goalkeeping instincts to keep that out. But the one that Fraser thingy, the guy who made all the saves the other night, apart from this one, he didn't really do anything apart from do sort of like the kind of star jump thing, which isn't really much. Your goalkeeper like makes himself big, and you've got to give him some credit for that, but it wasn't like that save. It really wasn't. I think Ozil should have scored. Should have scored from there. Lauren Koscielny should have scored. Should have scored. Heading over from whatever, 6 yards out. And that's the kind of position he's normally very good in. There were other chances as well. Fraser thingy made lots of saves. Alexis cleared off the line. A couple of headers. You know, we had the chances. And those are the fine margins. Really fine margins. The frustration that we all felt, and it was so tangible, the frustration on Tuesday night, you know, the difference if one of those goes in. But that's what it is. It's about mastering the fine margins in a season. And we don't seem to be doing that well enough at this moment in time. 3 points from 12, not really the kind of form that a title-winning team should be showing, to be honest. But look, before I sort of wander off on this all on my own, maybe we'll bring in this week's guest and have a chat about that and the rest of what's going on this week. Welcome back to the show to Tim Stillman.
Hello there.
Let's start with Southampton. I think we got to start there. The reaction to a 0-0 draw was perhaps not just based on what we saw on Tuesday night, as frustrating as that was, and clearly having had all those opportunities and chances to score, you know, it is a big frustration. But the other teams around us all won, and this is another disappointing result in a sequence of disappointing results. It felt like the weight of those, perhaps those last three or four Premier League games were there in the reaction to this one.
Absolutely, yeah. I was kind of talking about this last night. If this result, or sorry, that game, as much as the result had happened kind of in isolation after a couple of wins or 7 points out of nine or something, you might write it off and just say, oh, it was one of those nights. You know, we met a good goalkeeper in good form. We made some chances. Those games happen sometimes. But you're right, it's kind of what went on around it. You know, 3 points out of 12 and, you know, it's been in the post for quite a while, even kind of towards the end of December, beginning of January. Mm. You look at when we played Newcastle at home, for example, and we really, really huffed and puffed to that 1-0 win. And I actually think we played better, certainly in the second half against Southampton, than we did at any point in that Newcastle game. It's just, they're an incredibly poor team and we kind of got away with it. So it's been in the post for a little while, but yeah, it's just incredibly frustrating to miss those chances and, you know, to see the midfield just really not functioning. Mm. And I thought it was quite a conservative team selection from the manager. I think that really cost us, because sure, I can kind of understand the reason for the individual decisions. I can understand that at this point, Mikel Arteta is obviously completely incapable of playing at all if he can't get in ahead of, you know, Ramsey and Flamini together. Then I think we can just assume he is completely out of the picture. I can understand not wanting to rush Elneny. I can understand that Pear got a bit of a roasting from Shane Long. I can understand that Chambers is a bit untested in midfield, but I think not selecting at least one of those players was a bit of a mistake.
Do you think he could have gone with Coquelin and Ramsey? I mean, I guess with Coquelin, of course, he's being, you could almost understand that as well, having seen what happened to Thomas Rosicki, you know, and the little cameo that he made against whoever the fuck it was, Burnley.
Burnley, yeah.
You know, and he picks up an injury having just come back. And I think, you know, if something similar had happened to Coquelin, you know, people would have been saying, well, look, you started him two games in a row after he's been out for 2.5 months. So, that, you know, I can see why that's the case. But I think now, after what's happened with this, he's got to be braver with the team selection. He's got to find a way to make that midfield work again, because it's really not at this moment in time. And, you know, people will say Flamini this and Ramsey that, whatever you think about the individual merits of those players. I don't think either of them have ever or have let us down in terms of their effort or application.
No.
But certainly as a partnership, they just don't seem any closer to gelling than they did when the first time they played together.
No, absolutely. And Coquelin, to be honest, I completely defer to the manager on that one. He knows much more about what kind of shape he's in and what kind of reaction he might have had to the game on Saturday. You know, he might have had a bit of fatigue in the muscles, and, you know, that always makes things a little bit dangerous. And, you know, he's not really a ball playing sort either. And the manager probably reasoned that he was better used for the Bournemouth game on Sunday. So I do kind of understand that. But yeah, I think the kind of conservatism really hurt us. I look at it, it's really, really geeky, but I looked at the kind of passing combinations from Tuesday night. Flamini does not feature in any of the top 18 passing combos from the game. Ramsey only features once in like the top 10. What you actually had was the top two was Ozil to Alexis and Alexis to Ozil, the top two passing combinations, which is very strange for a game where you don't score a goal. And all of the other ones were kind of, you know, to bring to mind a clip from The Simpsons, it was kind of the fullback to the centre-back to the fullback.
Yeah.
Those were the top passing combos. So basically the midfield was completely bypassed.
That's interesting because Ramsey had kind of taken that role, that the Ramsey-Ozil connection had been working quite well when Ramsey came back into the centre. Because if you look back at the top passing combinations before Cazorla got injured, it was usually Cazorla taking the ball off one of the centre halves, Mertesacker. Yeah. So Cazorla-Mertesacker was really high, but Cazorla-Ozil was really high as well.
Yeah, there's a chain there, isn't there?
Yeah.
There's a very identifiable link. On Tuesday, our best passer from the back was Petr Cech. he delivered some of the best passes of the game, I thought, actually.
Yeah.
Which really says a lot because we had a couple of centre-backs who, you know, it's not really their forte either. So it was all a bit disjointed. And it just looked to me like in the second half, they almost made a really conscious decision just to definitely completely bypass that area and try and be a bit more direct. And it nearly kind of came off for us. But, you know, our finishing ended up being poor. And I think that was kind of a symptom of the game being so frantic.
Sure.
We didn't really have any control over it. We had to work really, really hard to get the ball in the box. So there was a real kind of lack of serenity there as well. But I mean, in isolation, I might have been able to compartmentalize this result a bit and just say, well, it's one of those things. But, you know, there's a frustration because you look at the way Leicester are playing at the moment. They attack every game and they try and take every single point they can get their hands on. And I think perhaps for us, there's been a bit of, you know, well, a 0-0 at Stoke's an OK result, a draw at Anfield's an OK result. And I think that's, you know, maybe we've just been kind of chasing fourth so long that we've kind of lost the killer instinct in
sure.
terms of, no, if you're going to win the league, you go and win those games.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard not to think that pressure, because I think that is a pressure. And whatever people might say about Leicester, I think they're there and they really don't have any pressure, because there's no weight of expectation on Leicester to continue doing what they're doing. Everybody's predicted, well, they'll fall away, and they haven't. And I think that allows them a certain freedom, this complete underdog thing that they have. Whereas with Arsenal, everybody is saying, well, if Arsenal don't win the league this season, this is their best chance, the best chance they'll ever have to win the league, etc., etc. And there's a lot of truth to that. There really is. You know, I think that could be evident in the performance, particularly in terms of the finishing, because the manager, for all the problems with midfield, and we might come back to midfield now in a minute, the manager might say, well, look, we had 20 attempts on goal. We had gilt-edged chances to score. It's fine margins. And we've spoken on this podcast, myself and yourself, before about mastering those fine margins in games that, you know, all that frustration evaporates if we get one goal and we take 3 points. But there's sort of an inherent pressure when you're expected to win those games and challenge for the title, and that might then speak to the character within the squad, which I think, and just I'll state, I think has improved considerably over the last couple of years anyway. But, you know, this is a different animal, winning the league.
It is, and, you know, I think there's an extra pressure on Arsenal because of some of the teams that are in the mix. It's kind of Leicester and Spurs. If Chelsea and Man United were in those positions, you know, there's almost a sense to which Arsenal would be the underdogs there. And with Man City, they probably are. But, you know, if Leicester and Tottenham are in the mix, there's really no hiding place for Arsenal there. Because I think if you get beaten to the punch by a couple of points by Chelsea and United, you've kind of got, you know, your excuses in, as it were, although I'd hesitate to call them excuses. But yeah. There's absolutely no hiding place when it's Leicester and Tottenham. And, you know, you look at Tottenham's run in, for example, and actually Tottenham have played a lot of their hard games already. They're playing most teams at home now, ourselves included. And so we're in a position now where we've got a lot of tough away games, and we're going to have to take quite a few points from them.
Do you think that pressure is something that the players will feel? I mean, certainly when we look at it and we think, well, the resources that we have, Leicester this time last season were bottom, more or less. They were like about to fight off relegation. Tottenham have always been Tottenham. And obviously that's a thing that we look at as fans and we think, well, hey, if they can do that, why can't we do that with everything that we've got and everything that we should have? But do you think the players look at it in the same way? Will they think, well, it's all, you know, because it's Leicester, it'll reflect badly on us?
Maybe. I think the manager will feel it. Whether
that's what I was going to say.
Counteracts that, I'm not sure. Whether the players do, I'm not sure. I suppose the thing we've got going for us there is that in doing, you know, the race for fourth for so many years, we've chased down teams like Leicester and like Spurs before, who don't have our resources, who go on good runs, but then kind of grind to a halt because their squads aren't as big and as good as ours. And that's something that's very much in our corner, particularly with Spurs, because there's history there, albeit I do think this Spurs team is a slightly different animal. But we do have that in our corner when it comes to chasing those two. Mm. Manchester City, you know, I always thought they'd win it, and I kind of still do. Albeit I think it will be very close. But I just think they've got a couple of players, they've got one player in particular who, if he stays fit, I think that he'll get them over the line.
Mm. Aguero, obviously, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, of course. That need for a clinical finisher was evident on Tuesday night against Southampton. It's hard not to think that a player like that would make a huge, huge difference to this Arsenal side, somebody who could put the ball away the way that Ian Wright put the ball away, for example. The difficulty, of course, is that those players are really, really difficult to find. A striker of Sergio Aguero's quality is extraordinarily rare, and I think that's what we're going to have to contend with. People can complain about Giroud all they want, and I understand the complaints, but the strikers out there that are better than him are few and far between, and if they do exist, they're at better clubs and bigger clubs than Arsenal. So we have to maybe look at different ways of getting our goals. And what you'd look at this season is perhaps the backup or the supporting cast to Giroud, who's got 18 goals, hasn't really done enough. Alexis has got 10, and he spent 2.5-3 months out injured. The top after that is 5 goals from Aaron Ramsey and Theo Walcott. We've got 3 from Joel Campbell, 1 from Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain. Are we at a point where we need to start making serious decisions about those players, that if we can't find the striker to get us the goals that we need to win the title, do we not then have to accept that some of the players, some of the other players, are not of the sufficient quality? That to make up that gap, we're going to have to bring in better players in other positions aside from striker, is my long-winded point.
Yeah, I think so. And I still think for a number of years, probably since Nasri left, I still think that Wenger wants... I'm second-guessing him entirely, but I think that there's one player he wants to complete that front three. I think he's happy, you know, definitely happy with Alexis playing, you know, principally on the left of that front three. I think he can make do with, you know, alternating Giroud and Walcott. I think that spot on the right, perhaps, I still think that that's an area he'll look in the summer. And perhaps, you know, someone of a kind of playmaker, goal scorer kind of ilk. Because if you look at the options we've been using there over the last couple of years, they've all been a little bit, you know, make do and mend. We've had Cazorla in the front three. We've had, you know, Ramsey playing from the right of the front three, and they've all been, you know, good options and kind of given us something. But I don't think that Wenger's ever been convinced that, yeah, this is my guy and this is where he's going to play, you know, for the rest of the time that he's here. It's almost like plugging gaps. I think he wants his world-class striker, and I don't think now you'll see another, you know, Welbeck-style signing up there. I think if he signs a striker, he's going to wait. It's going to be a bit Goldilocks. But I do think, yes, he will really have his eye on someone else for that front three who can make goals, because as well, the likes of Chamberlain and Walcott aren't really making many goals at the moment either.
Yeah.
And someone that, you know, perhaps can be a bit of an upgrade there. I think that's somewhere he'll seriously have a look in the summer.
Someone who can do for Arsenal what Mahrez is doing for Leicester, basically.
Yeah, yeah.
So Mahrez.
Basically, he's never replaced Pires.
Is
my estimation.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's why I sort of said it on the blog before this transfer window ended, that if he was going to buy two players, certainly a central midfielder was going to be one, and if he could find a player to play as a wide forward, if he could find that right player, if it was available in January, I think he would have done it, but I don't think the player that he wants is or will be available in January, which is,
no.
People might say, well, why didn't you do it in the summer, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, that's a different thing altogether. So look, what do we do then about midfield? If it were you, go, well, okay, so here we go. We're playing Bournemouth on Sunday. We've got to make it tick. We've got to make it work. What does he do for this game that might then be the solution for the rest of this season? Because that's what we need to find. We don't need to find a solution for a game against Bournemouth. We need to find a solution for big games, away games at Tottenham, away at Man City, away at Manchester United. You know, it's going to be tough.
It is. And I think what I would do and what I think he will do is just try and make Ramsey and Coquelin work. I don't think it's ideal. I don't think their attributes are brilliantly matched. There again, we haven't really seen them play together that often, and I don't think I'd have said off the top of my head that Cazorla and Coquelin would match each other as a kind of double pivot, and that worked. So you never know. But effectively, I think it's the simplest thing to do. You know, it's not an ideal partnership, but they're both very good players, and you know, they'll get somewhere, at least somewhere close to making it work. Effectively, while Cazorla's not there, I think Arsenal really miss a kind of a deep-lying player that can circulate the ball. But, you know, we don't really have one. His other option is to move Ramsey back to the right and bring Elneny in next to Coquelin. But I think that lacks a little bit of creativity. Probably takes away Ramsey's goal-scoring kind of prowess, which I think we're going to need. So, I mean, personally, I would just kind of mash Ramsey and Coquelin together and, you know, hope that they strike up some kind of partnership quite quickly. It's not that disruptive to the team. It will definitely work better than Ramsey and Flamini has. Coquelin, similar type of player to Flamini, but much better, much more proactive, much more likely to win you the ball back. You know, so that's probably what I would do. And I'm pretty certain that's what he will do. And I think that's what we'll see on Sunday against Bournemouth. And I'm convinced he kind of held Coquelin back because he thought, I can probably only start him for one of the two games. And he thought that Bournemouth would be the game to do that.
What do you think then about the right-hand side? I like Joel Campbell. I like what he's done this season. Credit to him for coming in and working really hard and making a decent contribution. But again, if we're going to talk about players who can help make the difference between a side, you know, finishing the top four and win the title, I'm still not convinced that he's a guy who can get us enough goals to do that. But does he at this moment in time present the best option for that right-hand side? He won't play Theo Walcott there at all. We know that. He hasn't played him there for well over a year now.
Yeah.
Because, you know, he's chosen when Welbeck was fit, when Wilshere was fit, when Ramsey was out there. They were all ahead of him.
Yeah.
And it was perhaps a little bit telling on Tuesday night that when we needed a goal to win that game, And the change that he made was to bring on Coquelin for
Flamini.
For Flamini. And, you know, I kind of got that substitution to an extent. If the team in the final few minutes were going to bomb forward and leave a bit of a gap at the back, then at least Coquelin is fresh legs and just has that defensive awareness. But Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain never even got a sniff. And, you know, he's the kind of player that in the past the manager has put on to try and win us a game. And you go back to the days when we would end up with Wiltord, Kanu, Henry, Bergkamp, you know, four strikers, sometimes five strikers. I mean, there have been times, haven't there, when Arsene Wenger has taken off a right back and we've ended up with essentially five or six forward players to try and get a goal. What can we view anything about the way he views the right-hand side?
I think he'll stick with Joel Campbell just because he kind of brings a bit of balance to the team. And I completely agree. I think where Joel Campbell's done well is to use a kind of arbitrary rating system. Well, I probably thought he was about a 5 out of 10 player, and actually it looks like he's about a 7 out of 10 player, you know, which is kind of, without wishing to sound too patronising, good on him. But I completely agree that it's still not a kind of title winning quality. It's a really difficult question because, I mean, Chamberlain's not exactly banging in goals and getting assists, albeit I thought he had a very decent game against Burnley. I do think he's been getting gradually better since Christmas, albeit from a fairly low bar. But I think he looks a little bit more sparky. The kind of problem is that I think a front three of Chamberlain, Alexis and Giroud just isn't really that balanced. And this is the problem, the challenge I think Chamberlain's got in his Arsenal career, that Chamberlain and Alexis on either side, I'm not sure how well that works really, because they're both very, very similar sorts of player. They're both kind of high risk, high reward. They both like taking players on. And it's, you know, it's a bit samey. And, you know, you're quite likely to lose the ball on both sides of the pitch with those two. So I think it will be really, really interesting. I thought the decision to bring Walcott on the right was a bad one as well. I thought that game was much more set up for Chamberlain, because when you've got a team that's sitting deep like Southampton, I think you've got to try and move them around, and that Chamberlain does that. I think that he'll start Campbell, but he might view Chamberlain as a good substitute option, particularly because Joel Campbell's energy levels aren't great either. He rarely lasts more than 65, 70 minutes. So I think he might go with that balance early on and then perhaps unleash Chamberlain for the last 20 minutes if required to give that kind of burst of energy. Because Bournemouth are going to, we know what we're going to get. They're going to work very, very hard. They're going to work us very, very hard. And bringing on a player like Chamberlain for the last 20 minutes might be the way to go.
Interesting about Theo Walcott, what you said there, and I agree with you completely. I think the lack of involvement he had on Tuesday night was, it was kind of astonishing to me, really, given that he played well over half an hour. I know he had a really good chance on goal, which he missed, which is symptomatic of his recent form. But, you know, he's always been a player who has divided opinion. I think that's fair to say.
Yeah.
He's had his critics, but for the most part, people have been, They've looked to see the best of him, in a way, shall I say. And it feels at this moment in time as if that tide has turned a little bit, that the frustrations that people have felt with this game for a long time are at the point of boiling over.
Yeah, absolutely. And in one respect, I can live with him not being hugely involved when he came on against Southampton. Joel Campbell wasn't either. And like I was saying about the passing combinations earlier, it was very, very biased towards the left. We tried to go down the right and Southampton just completely shut it off. And so in the second half, Ozil moved over to the left next to Alexis. And, you know, those two and Monreal were the ones that were really involved. The problem for Walcott is he has to score when he gets chances like that. And if he doesn't, then he's literally contributing nothing. That's why you have him in the team, because you accept that he might not contribute much, but that when he does, it will be decisive. And so it's a big problem for him to miss a chance like that. And also, I think there's a very good argument that, you know, while you might have sympathy with a player who is playing on the side of the pitch when none of the play is going, you probably have to ask, well, if you're paying a guy £140,000 a week, A, he shouldn't need, you know, it putting on a plate for him. That salary is for a difference maker. That salary is for someone like Ozil and Alexis. And the whole reason all of the play went through them is because they're our best players, and A, everyone wants to give them the ball, and B, they go and get it. So if you're paying someone £140,000 a week, that's what you want. You don't want
people
somebody
don't,
who's just going to wait for the ball to come to them.
People, yeah, but that's the thing. You can see sometimes that people don't necessarily want to give Walcott the ball.
Yeah, exactly. And again, that's fine in a sense. If he's scoring, you can kind of live with that. But then when he gets that chance, you know, you're paying him big money. And he agitated for that in quite a big way.
And to play as a striker, as somebody who could fulfill that role, who could do that job as a finisher.
Absolutely. And ultimately, that's always been his selling point, his end product. And if it's not there, then, well, we know by now, after 10 years, that he's never going to be brilliant at trapping the ball or a great passer. Like, we know all that now. It's been far too long for that to change. So, you know, he's in a position where he's got a couple of attributes. They're very, very useful ones, but if they're not firing to 100%, then, you know, he's ultimately useless. And at the moment, he looks useless, quite frankly. So it's just not what you want to see from someone who is ostensibly your highest earning player.
All right. Well, I'll leave you with the last word on that one. I get myself in trouble. Final thing I wanted to talk about: Alex Oxlade-Chamberlain causing waves in the tunnel before kickoff by dancing a little bit before they went out for the warm up. And bizarrely, people have lost their fucking reason over this. It's really weird, isn't it? I mean, I think you can judge certain things. For example, if you see a player in a game who's not making any effort, you can talk about lack of heart and fight and desire, even if in general those things are very intangible. You know, it was interesting to see some of the reaction after Tuesday, and, you know, how the players didn't want to win, which is just a bizarre thing to say. Yeah. Of course they wanted to win.
They didn't.
And, you know, you can analyze that and you can criticize them for not winning, but I don't think they didn't want to win, which is ridiculous. But the idea that Oxlade-Chamberlain has generated all these column inches simply because he's there in the tunnel with his teammates having a little bit of a laugh before the warm-up in a game in which he didn't even play.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it makes sense to me to have a little bit of a dance if you're just about to go and warm up, to be honest. If he'd done that walking off the pitch at the final whistle, I might have been a little bit worried, but it just means absolutely nothing. It is absolutely... Like, if we win that game 1-0 in the last minute and Chamberlain still doesn't play, who on earth would have, like, read anything into that whatsoever? And, you know, like, I was looking through clips of, Vieira and Keane in the tunnel, and it's not the famous tunnel altercation, but it's actually in the unbeaten season, and Vieira's just kind of laughing in the tunnel, and Roy Keane looks at him, and Vieira goes, "Oh, come on, smile, man." And, you know, it's just like, that was the season we went unbeaten. And then, you know, just put into YouTube Diego Maradona warm up and have a look at the shit he did, you know, when he was warming up.
Oh, there's one, isn't there? There's a brilliant clip of him and
just booting the ball in the air.
Yeah, there's music. Is it the Life is Life one?
Yeah.
Amazing.
It's like, yeah, he was obviously a loser that never achieved anything. When I used to sit in the clock end and we used to watch like a David Seaman and Alex Manninger warm up, They used to just play crossbar challenge, like they weren't preparing for the game at all. And again, but because, you know, because basically different, you've got a lot of nervous energy before a game, you're just about to go out and warm up, you know, and different people expend that nervous energy in different ways. Even if you wanted to microanalyze someone having a shuffle for 3 seconds in the tunnel with his mates before the game, but different people do it in different ways. And it's just... It's one of those, it's, you know, it's just kind of wise after the event. that, you know, someone probably does that in the tunnel or something similar before every single game that's played, and, like, you know, in the dressing room as well, that
we don't see.
I'm certain, you know, in every dressing room in the world, someone has a little dance or something. It's just totally meaningless.
But they talk about it all the time, like someone's in charge of the music and it gets the players going, and then you can be quite sure that there's guys dancing and there's guys who are sitting there, you know, ultra-focused. Yeah. It's like the tunnel bus stop story after this one, that Wenger was having a go at Lee Mason and Ronald Koeman came over and got involved, and apparently this is Wenger being involved in the tunnel. Like, if people knew the shit that goes down in tunnels after every Premier League game, every single week, the stuff that's said, the stuff that happens, the physical confrontations, all those things, you know, this is just bizarre. But it just seems like, you know, every little thing has to be a big thing these days.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. And, you know, you read stories about Wimbledon were quite open about, you know, the ghetto blaster in the dressing room and stuff like that. And they used to, like, lark and piss about and, you know, they used to, like, wind up the opposition and stuff and joke. You know, it's just, you know, it's just totally and utterly, it means absolutely nothing. And it's just, you know, it's just amazing that this guy, particularly when the guy doesn't even play, like, how does that even plug into the result at all? It's just, it's absurd, really. I mean, it's not like, you know, guys like Ian Wright or Thierry Henry ever, you know, danced a jig or anything. It's absurd. It really is.
Do we know what the song was that he was dancing to?
No, I can't remember.
Right. Okay. Well, maybe after we find that out.
Maybe he loses points.
Yeah, exactly. If it's something really terrible, then, you know, we might advocate selling him straight away, but not for the dancing itself. Tim, thanks very much as always. Great to talk to you.
Pleasure.
Thank you very much indeed to Tim Stillman. You can find him on Twitter @Stilberto, and of course read his column every Thursday on arseblog.com. Right, we're going to look ahead to the Bournemouth game. Don't have any real news on the team or anything yet. I'm kind of hanging on here on Thursday evening, hoping that something might drop before I finish this podcast. But if not, I'll just make something up, or, I don't know, talk about clouds. Grrr, clouds. Now, though, we've got some Amari Bischoff PI.
I was sitting there plotting my revenge against the entire bear population for not killing Leo DiCaprio when they had a chance, when the guy walked into the office. Not you again, mister, I said. Every time you come in here, you make my head hurt. Look, he said, I really need your help this time. Okay, I said, what can I do? Well, he said, I'm having a big problem with... With what, I said? What is it you're having a problem with? I seem to be having a great deal of difficulty in... Difficulty with what, mister? Come on. You gotta help me out a little here. I know, he said. It's just that I'm finding it really tough to... Jesus Christ, I said. Why can't you just finish? He turned to me. Hey, if I knew that, I'd be top of the... God damn it, I said.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Right, we will have more from Amari Bischoff, PI, on another Arscast in the very near future. So, looking ahead this weekend to the game against Bournemouth. Well, myself and Tim have sort of talked about midfield a bit, haven't we? And what he might do there, what he might do on the right-hand side. I think those are the only decisions that he has to make. Whether he'll be forced into another decision or not, or two, we'll have to wait and see. On Tuesday, Nacho Monreal, he looked a bit kind of banjax there towards the end. He went off to get some treatment and he was limping about the place quite badly towards the end of the game. So maybe Kieran Gibbs will come in for him if he doesn't make it. Aside from that, though, you know, I don't know what sort of changes he's going to make. Maybe Mertesacker back in the center of defense. But aside from that, whatever he does with the midfield, you got to hope that it works and it allows us to sort of exert some control over the games. I agree with Tim when he was saying that it was all a bit hectic against Southampton. Even with all those chances, it never felt like we were truly on top of them in terms of dominating the game and controlling it in the way that we have done in the past. So we'll hopefully be able to do that on Sunday against Bournemouth. And then after that, the fixtures, whoo, they get a bit tasty, don't they? Because we've got Leicester at home, then the FA Cup game against Hull City, then Barcelona, Manchester United away, then the Swansea at home, Tottenham away. Oh, yeah, it's all getting a bit hectic. So we do need to try and build some rhythm and we do need to get some points on the board. We can't afford to drop any more points. It's as simple as that. We've slipped behind a little bit. We need to get ourselves going again. So hopefully we can do that. Remember, you can check out everything that happens over the weekend, the live blog to follow the game with on Saturday, all the match reports, all the stats, all the player ratings and what have you. You'll find those on the website news.arsblog.com, or you can follow @arsblognews and get all the information there. So that's that. I'm going to leave this particular podcast here. There is no team news. So, clouds. Why are you so cloudy? You fucking big gray and sometimes white clouds with rain in them. Stop it. That should tell clouds. Let's keep fingers crossed for 3 points on Sunday. Man, we really, really need them. James and I will be here with an Arscast extra for you on Monday, although I think we're going to be recording on Sunday due to James going off to do very nice things for other people, which is to be commended. But we might talk about that on the podcast when it's released on Monday. So have yourselves a great weekend. Fingers crossed for the win. I'll talk to you on the next one. Until then, cheers. Bye-bye.
Arsenal Football Club today announced a freeze on season ticket prices for the new season. Unfortunately, due to global warming, that freeze has not remained in place. Prices have soared out, and fans will have to pay more. Chairman Sir Chips Keswick said,
"If the TV companies can pay a bit more, then why can't the fans?"
Payments will be deducted automatically from children's trust funds.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.